On the Empire podcast this week, we get inside the gigantic brains of Pete Docter and Jonas Rivera, who made Inside Out, and then ask the little people inside how it came about. All that and more on the movie podcast that reacted to the news of an emoji film with thumbs down, frowny face, and googly-eyed poo. Hello, pod listeners. I am Helen O'Hara. I am not Chris Hewitt. And you're listening to the Empire podcast, which this week is brought to you in association with Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or an online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code EMPIRE. That offer code again, because it's very difficult to remember, EMPIRE. So hello everybody. As you may have guessed, Chris is on an actual holiday. For once, he's not on a set visit. He is currently running around the Big Apple with two of his mates. It's kind of like On the Town, but their sailor suits are more garish. So they're having a great time, I believe.
I think it's more like Home Alone 2.
More like, well, it's probably a little bit like Home Alone 2, let's be honest.
More like Escape from New York for everyone else in New York.
For everyone else in New York, exactly. You may have heard them already, but I'm joined by two extremely lethal colleagues. I think that's the phrase. I don't know. Chris keeps saying it.
I thought you were going to say handsome.
I was going to say handsome Dan, but I was just worried it would give me away. So if he were an emoji, I think Dan Jolin would be the monkey covering his eyes. I don't quite know why. That seems like you. Oh my God, that's uncanny. He just covered his eyes and he looks just like the monkey.
Ook.
Ook indeed. And with us too is James Dyer, who if he were emoji would simply be the red devil face.
I think that's fair.
Is there a thundercloud emoji?
I don't know. I don't use emojis. They really upset me.
Hmm. I just like the classic, you know, colon,
bracket.
Uppercase D kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, have very happy face.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Or X, uppercase D.
It was the colon P one that used to annoy me. It was the sort of the wagging tongue sort of emoticon thing. Yeah, I can't be dealing with that.
Oh, that's a very useful one. I use that all the time.
I've never really felt in a kind of I can illustrate my mood by hanging my tongue out.
So I think it's helpful, you see, if you're being a little bit snarky at someone, but you don't want them to think you're actually being rude.
Anyone who's got an Apple Watch, I don't have one, incidentally, but you can like make the emojis you can amplify them, so you can make them happier or less happy. They have sort of stages of, you know, joy.
Wow, just like a film we'll be getting to later in the podcast. Wonderful. So we better get on to some questions. I have one here from I think I'm saying this name right, at Dick Squinty, aka Peter Woolman. Hello, Peter. After having Gone Girl ruined by an episode of Selfie, have you had a film or TV show ruined while watching something else? That's a good question.
I definitely have, yes.
Yeah?
Yes. It was an episode of The Simpsons, and it was a gag, a Mayor Quimby gag. He's speaking to a crowd full of people, and he says, and I'm not going to try and do the impression, he said, "In other news, the chick in The Crying Game is really a man." And I hadn't seen The Crying Game at this point.
Oh, no.
And I'd kind of, somehow, I don't know how, managed to avoid actually finding that out. Really, honestly, it's a mystery how I managed it. But I had, until I saw it. But that's the gag in the film, because all the people of Springfield are like, boo, at him after he says that. And I was just like, okay, fair enough. Statute of limitations, fair game. But it did. And actually, I have genuinely not seen The Crying Game because I can't be bothered now.
Wow. I mean, it's a good film otherwise. Yeah. Even if you know the twist, which you all now do, spoiler.
Yes. Boo!
it is worth checking out. How about you, James?
I have never had anything... I don't think I've had something spoiled. I've had many things spoiled by The Empire Office.
Yes.
Nick ruined a certain scene. You know what? I'm not even going to say what it is. A certain character, a beloved character, dies in the final season of The Wire. And Nick came up to me the day after it had aired, and I hadn't watched it yet, and just said, insert name here, R.I.P. Promptly murdered him.
Were you a little bit upset?
I was absolutely incandescent. But even that paled in comparison to... I came to Twin Peaks very, very late. Like about 4 years or so after it aired. But somehow, you know, pre-internet, no one had ever told me who killed Laura Palmer. And an ex-girlfriend of mine, who I had, shall we say, a problematic relationship with, came up to me on a Saturday night and just went up and said, "Laura's father killed her," and turned around and walked off.
What is a sort of a deliberate...
I'm going to ruin the show, which I know you've just discovered and are loving.
You see, it leaked out. I remember I was at school when Twin Peaks was on originally, and we watched it, and it leaked out. Basically, someone in my class, you know, said, oh, well, I've heard who did it, and then I found out, like, weeks and weeks before it got to it. Because it was, I don't know how it got out there. This is pre-internet, you know.
Yeah.
I ruined The Apprentice for everyone in the office.
You did?
Yeah, the first season of The Apprentice, I knew who won because I'd met the person who won randomly through a friend. And I came and said, oh, yeah, I was talking to the person who wins The Apprentice, because obviously being completely inured against popular culture and not knowing anything about it, I had no idea it hadn't aired. And I just talked about it, and everyone in the office just stared at me. I was like, what? I don't understand.
And then they ran to the bookies. No, they didn't. Yeah. They didn't.
No, they did. They did not take that information and profit from it.
Yeah. But it's yeah, it's a weird thing. I think there have been some. I struggle to remember specific instances. I think I saw When Harry Met Sally, though, before I'd seen Casablanca. And they talk about the end of Casablanca and Harry Met Sally and the fact that she goes off with her husband instead of obviously staying with Humphrey Bogart. Come on, girl. And that was obviously talked about in the film at great length. So when I went into Casablanca, I knew that. But then Casablanca is so good, it doesn't matter.
It's funny, isn't it? It's like this thing, this whole spoiler culture thing. Let's not get too into it. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I knew the ending of Casablanca. Everyone knows the ending of Casablanca because it's such a classic ending. You know, there's certain things. You know the ending, but what does it matter? Who cares?
I disagree. And
also, as a child, I used to read book series in the wrong order. I used to watch movies in the wrong order. I saw Empire Strikes Back before I saw Star Wars.
Me too.
And, you know, so what? Does it matter? Does it matter that you know that Darth Vader is Luke's father before you see it? Of course it doesn't.
Yes, yes, 1,000 times yes.
No,
you
really...
absolute lunatic. Of course it matters. Honestly, my brain is itching just from hearing you talk. Yes, you have to watch things in order. No, you must never know spoilers. It doesn't necessarily ruin what is an otherwise great film, but it definitely diminishes it. It is far better. I'm absolutely with J.J. Abrams on this. I think everyone will be far better and enjoy movies much more if they turned up at the cinema having never seen the trailer, having never heard anything about it, and just experienced it for the first time. I'm the complete opposite of Chris, who reads the spoilers for everything before he watches it.
And even stuff he doesn't watch.
I know.
I'm somewhere in the middle here, so I'm going to have some balance. I think there is something to be said for certainly a statute of limitations on spoilers. The person who wrote in and complained that we spoiled the ending of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari remains wrong, like just profoundly wrong. On the other hand, I thought there was something wonderful about the fact that when the first season of Game of Thrones aired, pretty much everybody I know who had read the books kept their mouths shut. And we just sat there with our loved ones who hadn't read them and we grinned as they cried and screamed and wept.
Although James did ruin something in season one of Game of Thrones for me.
Did I? What did I ruin?
The death of, what's his face? Daenerys' brother. You looked at a picture of Harry Lloyd as Viserys and went, oh, he doesn't last long.
James.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Sorry, Dan. Sorry.
Guilty.
But obviously it didn't diminish it for you because you don't mind spoilers.
No. Well, you know, all I'm saying is there's more to the enjoyment of a film and to a film's quality than its plot.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, I think we can all agree on that. So before we disagree on anything else, I'm going to move us swiftly along.
Okay.
Let's go to news. So there has been some good news and some bad this week. I mean, we've already touched on the fact that they're making a film based on emojis. So I feel like we should have a quick discussion of that. You know, they made a very good film based on Lego. Does that give you hope?
They made a good film based on Facebook as well. So, you know, hope springs eternal. But no, this is the end of civilization as we know it. We should all just kill ourselves now. I think that's fairly safe to say.
Well, that's the balanced viewpoint. Dan, can you give us any hope?
I am open-minded.
Yes.
However, I still can't get my head around how they're going to make a movie of Monopoly, you know, the board game thing. And obviously they failed to make a movie about Battleship. This is just, you know, Lego, I get. I mean, there was a really nice concept at the heart of it. And I'm interested to see how the Minecraft movie will not just do the same thing. But this just really, what? I mean, and, you know... Sony Pictures Animation as well. The Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs movies, brilliant.
Yes.
Hotel Transylvania, yeah. So, yeah, it's when I hear more about what the story actually is and whether there's any actual characters in it and whether or not they have that thing that we were just talking about earlier, which is a plot. I mean, you know, once I hear more, I'll tell you what I think. But I remain skeptically open-minded.
Nicely put.
Are we so devoid of ideas that this is what it's come to? Taking ersatz pieces of non-punctuation and turning them into narrative. It's the end of days. This is a sign of the apocalypse. It's in the Bible. It's honestly.
It's in the Bible?
I mean, yes.
You're a theologian,
yeah,
so I trust you.
It's a lesser known imprint of the Bible, I'll be honest with you.
Actually, true. I have been noticing cats marrying dogs.
Yeah. So cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria, emojis falling from the sky into our cinemas. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to make a movie. I'm going to write a screenplay about apostrophes because, you know, brilliant.
I mean, they do feature in a lot of screenplays, but they've never really had their day in the sun.
They've never shone.
I look forward to seeing that. Let's move on to happier stuff. Now, obviously, podcasts are an audio medium, so it makes perfect sense to talk now about trailers. Mm-hmm. And there have been two really very exciting ones this week. This is the Spectre trailer, the first real look at the new James Bond film.
Yes.
And The Revenant, which I think we're all extremely excited about. Which is obviously DiCaprio's Western starring.
Or is it a Western?
Or is it? Isn't it?
It's not technically a Western, no.
Is it, Northern?
When I say technically, I mean I don't believe it takes place in the period from the end of the Civil War to the end of the 20th century, which is when Westerns tend to be set. It's more of a frontiers kind of story, earlier frontier story. But it's based on, I want to say the truth. I want to say a true story.
I believe
it's based on a novel which was based on a true story.
Right.
But I correct me. Write in. Come in. Email us if I got that wrong. No. But it's DiCaprio plays a guy who is attacked by a bear and left for dead. And then because Revenant, if you've seen The Returned, which is Les Revenants, you will know that it means The Returned. So he comes back to get his vengeance. So it sounds very sort of...
No, just to be clear, that's not the vengeance on the bear. That's the vengeance on the people who left him. Is that
which
correct?
Which is a shame, because I'd like to see Man versus Bear.
I mean, yes, that would also be an exciting film.
Well, we've seen The Edge. I mean, you know, there is that. But it's a very sort of straightforward plot. It feels very familiar, but you watch that trailer and it just seems like something else entirely. It looks like a kind of, you know, Apocalypse Now, but in the mountains.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing, right? Now, this is what I've heard about The Revenant. I don't know how common knowledge this is. They've been shooting entirely by natural light, apparently, and they've only managed to get about 15 minutes shooting a day as a result, certainly for parts of the shoot. So it's basically Lebesgue's third consecutive Oscar for best cinematography, presumably. I mean, other cinematographers are going nuts for this thing.
This is Deakins. This has got to be Deakins' year for Sicario. Sorry, just saying.
I
13 times, no, 12 times nominated, never won.
I know. But this is the thing that people are losing their minds over.
Yeah, I suppose.
So it's going to be interesting because, honestly, I would agree. I mean, Deakins is two decades overdue, easily. But at the same time, I'm not sure this is anybody else's year. That's a huge, huge commitment to take on. So full marks to Chivo and Iñárritu for daring something so completely crazy.
Yeah, no, it sounds, honestly, it just sounds like an absolute crazy nightmare of a shoot. Isn't this the reason that Tom Hardy couldn't do Suicide Squad in the end? Because it overran so much, because the weather was wrong, they couldn't get the right light, they had to wait around for ages. It's a great story all round.
Yeah.
I love it.
And there is something special about the light in that trailer. It does look amazing, so I'm quite excited.
You can't beat natural light.
No.
And yet only the second most exciting trailer we saw this week.
Indeed. So talk to me about Spectre.
Bond is back. That's all there is to say. I was very excited. But then, I mean, that's redundant, isn't it? When were we not going to be? It's a Bond trailer. It's got Bond. You've got Christoph Waltz being, you know, about as Blofeldy as it's... He's basically holding a cat in all but literal sense. But it's great to see it all cut together. It looks fantastic. Dan, you're a Bond nut as well, aren't you? So
Yeah. I thought it looked amazing. I thought it looked spectacular, actually.
Yeah.
You could see everything there that you want from a Bond movie. Obviously, globetrotting, beautiful women, but also, you know, now they're sort of like, they're looking like properly empowered, you know, sort of... With, you know. Leia Seydoux looks great, don't you think?
She does,
she's really crucial to the story, as opposed to just, you know, being a bit of kind of dressing around the edges.
Yes, I mean, we're definitely cleaving close to the idea that one out of every two women is evil, I suspect, or doomed.
Yeah.
You can be either evil or doomed. It's up to you, kids. but sure, yeah. Mm. I mean, she looks interesting.
The Bond women looked great.
Yes.
I thought. I'm ridiculously excited about the prospect of Christoph Waltz as the Bond villain. It's one of those. I do feel like we're having a John Harrison situation with Christoph Waltz in this film, where the official line is just feels so obviously a sham, where it's just like, yeah, come on, why didn't you just all just say it's Blofeld and let's all enjoy the fact? But again, could be wrong.
James, I am the architect of all your pain.
Yeah, I do think this is obviously.
Does it have to be personal though? Does it?
Yeah, it's always personal.
That's the thing. I do put, this isn't a diss at this new Bond, which I'm absolutely enjoying, but I do prefer Bond when it's not personal, and he's. I like the fact that he's licensed to kill.
He's
it's his job. So I like almost like the way that, you know, he doesn't have an investment personally in what's happening. He's just having to do the things that other people won't do in order to save the world. Mm. And this new Bond cycle, if you like, is making it more about the character and everything. But it's fine. I mean, you know, that's the flexibility of the character and the joy of the character. You can do lots of different things with it. So, you know, fine. It makes it more interesting in some ways. But I don't know. I just like the idea of Bond being just a cold professional.
Mm. I'd have liked to hear a little bit more Bautista in the trailer. There was a flash,
yeah,
a glimpse.
There's a few flashes, I think, but it's always very much, I think a couple of the punches that seem to come from various directions are his because they were, you know, large and intimidating. I really wish him well because I met him on set of Guardians of the Galaxy and he is the nicest man ever. He just looks like a terrifying beast. So it's good that he's getting to use those looks in the pursuit of, well, beating up James Bond, which I also approve of. So this is a win-win for me.
And Andrew Scott as well, brief appearance.
Yes, with no explanation, no context, no hints as to what he might be doing. Mm. Just standing there looking like Moriarty, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe that he's not to be a trustworthy character in this.
What? Andrew Scott, not trustworthy? Yeah.
But then I thought that about Ralph Fiennes in Skyfall.
True.
I thought he was going to be a nefarious type, and then he ended up being M.
Indeed.
But then you never know, maybe he's a member of Spectre, and even though he's M. Imagine that.
That would be clever. They haven't done that before, don't
they?
No,
they haven't. They haven't actually had M be the bad guy. Although the first Mission Impossible film kind of did that.
I guess League of Extraordinary Gentlemen did that. The book.
It did. You're right.
Hail Spoiler. Spectre.
Hail Hydra. Damn it. I'm sticking to my guns. And there was also slightly worrying news in terms of Goonies.
What was worrying, Helen?
Goonies never say reboot.
What's worrying about this situation?
Well, Goonies never say die, and they do say reboot, basically, is the concern. Everybody always says reboot, don't they? So it is now the Goonies' turn. It's a surprise it's taken this long. It's been, you know, rumoured many times over the years, and it looks like we're in for it.
Who's involved, Helen?
Well, it's the person who's been involved basically all along. It's Chris Columbus. Now, he is a guy who we know can launch a kids' film. I give you Harry Potter, among many, many others. So he did the first Home Alone as well, didn't he, of course?
He
knows his onions in this respect. And this they are calling this a reboot. Last time they were sort of talking about it being a sequel and having the Goonies be the parents of the new Goonies. And it's not clear if this will still be the case. It's still pretty much in the early stages, but it's basically a reaffirmation that Chris Columbus is still working on a Goonies film.
Let's be honest, though. The original.
Yeah.
Not actually that great, is it?
Oh, my God.
I have a fondness towards it. I liked it as a kid, but it's not. It doesn't hold up in the way that Back to the Future holds up. It doesn't hold up in the way, obviously, the original Star Wars trilogy holds up.
Professionally wrong.
What?
It's brilliant. It's the Goonies.
It has a scene at the end where someone refers to an octopus that wasn't in the film.
It was in the film. It's just not in the final cut of the film.
Yes, that's exactly my point.
So they cut a scene. It happens. What do you want?
I don't know.
I really like it. I think it's great. You know, I love the Fratellis. I love Sloth. I like the adventure. Perhaps this is just me showing my age. It feels like it's missing from a lot of sort of kids' adventure films these days. That sort of, you know, that sense of sort of mustiness and the practical effects and the sets and like the organ when they're pricing and the gag. If you get it wrong, we'll all be flat. Come on, Data with his boxing glove and his pincers of power. It's, you know, it's, and the truffle shuffle. There's nothing about this film that isn't brilliant. You're just wrong.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, you hold it up against some of those other kind of, you know, Amblin style 80s adventure things, and I'm not sure it's A grade. It's a kind of B grade.
You're B grade.
Harsh.
Mm. But reboot it. Why not?
Why not?
It's just like, Dan, whatever. This is the context of a world where an emoji movie is being made. I mean, you know.
He's not wrong.
Goonies reboot is just like fair dues.
It's the least of the offences.
Bring along, let's have some fun. But do it practical, like James said, do it practical effects. No CG allowed, right? Okay, no. I'm laying down the law right now. Columbus, you're listening to me.
I'm sure he is, Dan.
Listening to me. Keep it in camera, dude.
Mm. Wow.
Keep it in camera.
Strong words there from Dan Jolin. Yeah. Columbus, I'm sure you're listening, so hope that helps. That's the big news, I think, this week. Rob McElhenney took over the Minecraft movie. That's still going ahead.
They're building it brick by brick.
Kate Blanchett, who's directed quite a lot of theatre, I think I'm right in saying, is now directing Australian TV drama, Stateless. So look out for her becoming a kick-ass movie director, hopefully, sometime in the future.
Ooh.
And The Rock is once again teaming up with the San Andreas director, Brad Peyton, for Rampage.
That being the adaptation of the computer game?
Yeah.
In which King Kong and Godzilla, like...
Well, actually...
Sort of fight each other to destroy the most buildings?
It's not Godzilla. It's there are three people. And it's Ralph is the Wolfman, and Lizzie...
No, he's definitely not the Wolfman. He's something like the Wolfman.
No, this is what I'm saying. Ralph is the Wolfman. He's the man that becomes a wolf, in the literal sense. Lizzie is the lizard. And I can't remember the name of the guy who becomes
George.
The gorilla. George, who becomes a gorilla. Yes. Ralph was always my favourite. Anyway, the point is they get the three humans, they get magically turned into these big things, and then they have to smash buildings as quickly as possible within the time limit. That is the game. I played it quite a lot on the ZX Spectrum back in the day. Quite a lot of fun. But it is just punching buildings.
I remember it being fun. But
not,
I mean,
known for its story.
It's like, you know, so they just done San Andreas, in which lots of buildings collapse. Mm. Before that, they did Journey to Mysterious Island, in which an entire island collapsed.
Yeah.
Sorry, spoiler. And not really. And now it's going to be another film with The Rock and lots of buildings collapsing.
But here's the thing. Like, what do you want The Rock to do in your film apart from make buildings collapse? I don't even understand what you're complaining about.
Drive cars.
Okay, fair enough.
Into buildings and make them collapse. Yeah.
There we go. Now it's time for this week's interview. Pete Docter is the man behind Monsters, Inc. and Up, so he's already earned his place in movie heaven. That's safe. Now he brings us on a journey into the mind that makes the numbskulls look like complete numbskulls. Inside Out is, and this is a spoiler for the reviews section, this is amazing, and we asked Docter and Jonas Rivera, who's the producer, to tell us all about it.
Let's get cracking with John and the Empire podcast by Jonas Rivera and Pete Docter to talk to us about the new Pixar movie Inside Out.
Hi.
As a professional journalist, we normally try not to say how much in love with a film we are before we start an interview, because it seems somehow unprofessional. But I just can't not say that I'm totally in love with this movie.
Oh,
and it's a
thanks.
Film that it's kind of like Pixar films are stuffed with Easter eggs, so they obviously kind of reward repeat viewings, but I kind of wanted to sit in the cinema after it finished and watch it again.
Good.
Can you tell me how many viewings you think would be optimum on this movie? Because there's so much going on in it.
That's a great question.
Well, if you watched as much of us, just start devoting the next 5 years of your life and hit play.
We do, though. I don't know the number. That's a really cool thing to think about.
Is.
But we always thought, we're big like Disneyland fans, and we always thought about it like riding Pirates of the Caribbean at Disneyland, where every time you go through it, even now, my life going there, I see something new every time. And so we try to make the films rich enough and full of little things that we've put in there so that on repeat viewings, it's still a sense of discovery.
Yes. You reward your love of Disney World, Disneyland, by destroying the castle in the film.
Yeah, we do.
Right.
We do.
That's right. That makes me laugh every time. I don't know why.
That's not one of those things that
Maybe
Disney
of
like.
The glitter.
Yeah, it's like insulting the Pope or something. Something you just can't do within the Disney family.
Right. Or the castle. Well, it's high stakes. It's you know, it's imagination land.
Things are changing.
Yeah.
Stuff happens. What can you say?
It's not our fault.
No. It's not our fault. You made it. It's totally your fault.
Okay, it is our fault.
I mean, it has been. I think 2009 was the inception of the project.
Right.
So that's 6 years ago, obviously. Is there, how do you sort of keep, because you've kind of gone off and helped with other Pixar films in the interim, mm-hmm. come back mm-hmm. to it, mm-hmm. the story's developed, you've let go of things, added things. How do you keep sort of a perspective on this? Do you ever feel like you're just too close and you're not quite sure what's working, what's not working?
Well, there are times when that does happen, you get so close, and we have processes, is that the pronunciation?
Mm-hmm, I think.
To allow for perspective. We screen the film. We make the film in some sort of like storyboard, the hand-drawn version, and we screen it for other people every 3 months. And that has the effect of making you step back and looking at it as a film. Because, you have a tendency to get in there and hone things, and you really get into fine detail. So those screenings, I think, are pretty essential to keeping us fresh.
And you guys at Pixar, within the Brains Trust and within the bigger Pixar family, are not afraid to say what you really think about stuff to each other.
Sometimes we're afraid, but we know that it has to be said.
Yeah, we rely on it, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, that's our chance to look at it as a movie, think about what the audience might think, and just talk to it on a level of what confuses us.
Yeah, because look, I mean, every one of these films is pretty lousy. Some of them downright suck. And then they're at varying degrees of crappy for quite a long time. The worst would be that we didn't tell each other the truth and we release them and they're crappy.
Yes.
So what we're trying to do is hedge that, cut that off at the pass and get the crappy out.
Nobody comes up to you and go, Pete, your film is at a stage of crappy, but I can see less crappiness in the future and then possibly something good beyond that.
We don't quite phrase it that way, but it's essentially that's what the notes are.
we don't. Sometimes maybe we hear that, but more often than not, you hear things like someone like Andrew Stanton in a room with notes saying, you know what, I see where you're going, but I don't care. I don't think you're giving the audience enough to care about to pull them through, or something like that.
Yeah. Or your main character, I don't like your main character. That was one we got a lot
on
this film.
With Joy, really? She was hard to find because, her name's Joy. She's so written out of the kind of gate. She's just positive all the time. Happy, believes everything's going to work.
Energetic.
And as you even say that, you can imagine, it's a character you kind of want to run away from. And she's the main character, and you need to... So we worked hard to, and based on notes that we would get in feedback, to course correct and find the right path to write her.
Yeah, cause she could be like a young version of one of those breakfast TV anchors.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm okay with 10 minutes with this.
But yeah, exactly.
Beyond that, I really want to...
Hour and a half?
Exactly. Right.
She was the hardest. I mean, I should put this into context for the listeners.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to be able to properly explain the exact kernel of the story well enough to put out in front of you guys. But obviously, it's the story of Riley, who moves from Minnesota, age 12,
mm-hmm.
with her family,
11,
to San Francisco. She's 11, I apologize, mm-hmm. which is obviously where you're from, Pete, originally, Minnesota, which we'll probably come back to in a minute. And it's told from her perspective and also with inside her mind.
Yeah, because she's kind of the setting.
Yes.
For this story, because the mind world and the characters in there, her emotions, are really the main characters of the movie.
Yes. There's not really any kind of precedent for this, apart from perhaps Woody Allen's Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, which is, I must stress, nothing like this movie.
There are a number of things. People kind of bring up, like, Herman's Head, which I have actually never seen. There's the short film...
Resented Emotion.
Yeah, that came Disney out in the film. 40s.
Right.
But, there's nothing that's been quite constructed in this way, hopefully.
Yeah.
That was our goal.
It's
do something new.
Yeah. It's an unbelievably amazing way of creating the sort of internal landscape of the mind, which is such a phenomenally complicated thing, obviously. And your film is kind of being analysed by psychologists. And I don't know if you've read any of the pieces in newspapers, and they're like, we've got a top, emeritus professor from Harvard to study inside out and tell us that it's actually really accurately represents the human mind. It's like, that's a lot of pressure.
We got a Harvard professor to go see a Pixar film. That's
we're proud of that, whether they liked it or not.
Yeah.
But no, we did a lot of research. I mean, obviously when this idea came about, we wanted to learn more about the mind and memories and of course, emotions. So we spoke with a lot of folks about that and what the geography of the mind might be, or how many emotions are there, and what are their clinical definitions, and we found there was great debate on that specific topic, and which gave us a little license, I think, to be interpretive. I mean, Pete said early on that this thing should be the mind, not the brain, literally.
Right.
So we got to be metaphoric with things, but that was, I guess, a bit of a blessing and curse.
Yeah.
It was open-ended and fun and explorative, but it was also open-ended.
we had to
force ourselves to close doors.
Yeah.
One of the things I really loved about it was that it kind of it shows the point of sadness, Well, not to make it sound like Lars von Trier's Antichrist, but you know, there's a moment where Riley becomes depressed, and sadness is her sort of almost her escape back to herself a little bit, and sadness has a role, and you show the flip side of these emotions and how joy can be kind of frustrating and sadness can be important. I wonder, from a filmmaking point of view, which is the least useful of the emotions represented in the film?
Well,
I mean, anger and disgust, anger, I guess, are the two candidates, but is there a place for them all?
Hopefully anger is in there. Disgust, probably less so, although there are plenty of films that have that play with that a lot.
Yeah. Well, okay, Dr. Paul Ekman, right, who we worked with, who's a sort of pioneering figure in emotions and descriptions and so forth, he would tell you anger is really important, right?
Right. I mean, but from a filmmaking standpoint, I guess.
Oh, for the filmmaking,
you know,
from
there,
the story.
There are plenty of films that make you angry, right?
I see, yeah. They're
probably, as I think about it, okay, so there are a lot of gross-out humor that depend on disgust. But angry, like you, as a filmmaker, you don't really want your audience walking out angry. So I would choose
I guess
anger.
You're right.
But there are filmmakers who are known for being quite... can be incandescent on set, for instance, and who are very placid.
Making through the process, anger really drives you in a lot of ways.
Does it?
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, a lot of times you get frustrated by the process, and you're like, why is this so hard, and why can't... And that sort of powers you through, that anger. Or you know, sometimes, frankly, we'll get notes that I just really upset me in some way. And what you realize later is that's because I was not being clear. And I interpreted this note as directed towards me in an unfair way. And that's actually the trigger for anger is if you feel like you're getting taken advantage of or ripped off or something. So it can be a real driver.
Good.
Same with fear. You know, there was a big change in the film that we made based on the feelings of fear that, crap, we're going to get fired. We're going to, you know, I'm a failure. That sense, not that I was at any point literally thinking I'm going to get fired at all, but that sense of failure is a big driver. And
that it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And that's on you and us. And
yep.
Yeah. Which, John, as a producer and Pete as the writer-director, you guys worked together obviously on Up as well.
Yeah.
And I wondered... I mean, Up is something that's become... It's almost like before Up, there was Bambi's mum, and now there's the first 10 minutes of Up. And I mean that in the highest possible complimentary way. It's something that's still incredibly powerful to people. Did you have a sense of its cultural... Do you have a sense of its cultural importance? It's almost like people talk about that first 10 minutes as a film in itself, as well as the bigger film around it.
Yeah, we you know, it's really nice. Hear you say it. We've heard that quite a bit, and It comes up in talking about film. I've heard it, you know, in film discussions, and it moved. You know, it worked. It landed. And I knew when you guys first pitched it to me, you and Ronnie, and Bob Peterson, I knew it was really important. And if we did our job right, it could be really obviously important to the movie. But even reaching outside of the movie, we're really proud of it because I love that it's silent. And it speaks to what animation does really well, right? It's performance and storytelling just visually.
And even the way we approached it production-wise, Jonas, you kind of set it up as its own little short film.
It's like its own movie within the movie.
Yeah, with people who are devoted to it. In part because there were so many different sets and things. Just procedurally, it seemed to work that way. But also, it was such a jewel that we wanted to make sure it didn't get messed up.
Yeah, we didn't want to focus on the objects like the desks and the set and the wall in the hospital on its own. We wanted to focus on it as a cut.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how
this
we approached it.
This is a pure form of filmmaking, just knowing where to
put the
camera.
Thank you so much.
Well, because it worked in boards, and Ronnie Del Carmen had boarded a lot of it, and as we would rework it, got added to it and changed and refined, because it started out quite long, and we cut it down eventually to 4.5 minutes. But, like, you know, we knew that it worked in boards. In fact, a couple people suggested, don't even produce it. Just release the hand-drawn boards, because they were
thinking that.
Really beautiful.
I know. I think why it has resonated is because, and it speaks, and it gets back to Inside Out, it's something that you don't expect from animation, I think. And it's one of those things that the audience saw, and they were not used to this. What is this? This doesn't feel like an animated movie. It's something new. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was something completely different. And that's what really fuels us. Whether it's emotions coming to life or imagination land or all these fun things, is like showing the audience something that they might not expect to see, even within the medium, you know, an old man and the story of a life and his life, that was you know, that was new to people.
This film is full of those things. You know, I mentioned the moment of depression you don't expect to see in an animation.
Mm,
I don't want to make this film sound like it's depressing. It's not, but there is a moment. And I think maybe there's been a small sense in recent years that Pixar maybe lost a little bit of that, perhaps, you know, with becoming more, making more sequels, perhaps, and films that haven't landed quite as hard as some of the others. Mm. Did you have a sense of that within the organisation? Is that something that increases pressure on a film like Inside Out to deliver?
Well, I think every film we approach with our all, you know, we give everything we've got into it. And, you know, the sequels are very difficult and challenging, almost more so in some ways,
right,
than the originals. So we don't really differentiate and put them in a separate bucket or anything. But, you know, every film is an organic, weird, it has its own kind of life to it. And it, you know, you can't control these things to every level that you'd like, you know. So you just try your best. You put everything you've got into it, and some work for people. Some, I mean, every film I think people have liked, you know, in some way. But some films seem to speak louder than other films, I guess.
San Francisco is Pixar's town. Are you a little myth that every other movie in town has decamped San Francisco this year and tried to destroy it?
You know, what's funny is people have said, watching our film, they're waiting for the bridge to get blown up or something.
Yeah,
because it doesn't happen.
That's why it's in movies. No, it's strangely, yeah, the people in San Francisco seem to like those movies when it's getting destroyed.
Oh, they do?
Destroyed for some reason.
Yeah. We need to get Godzilla into the next Pixar somewhere in the background.
Yeah.
It's an Easter egg. Toy Story 4.
Yes.
Who had the first conversation? Where was the first moment that was raised within Pixar?
You know, that was in John's office, and we were actually, John, Andrew, and myself were there to talk about something on one of our shows.
Yeah.
But then somehow, I don't even remember exactly the conversation, it got derailed and ended up coming with this idea that John got super excited about, and
that's how things work there, right? We start off on one thing, and, you know, conversations.
So the conversation started with something else,
totally,
and ended up with you guys making
Toy Story
4. It was
not intended. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. There's certain ideas that have been kicked around as part of the. I mean, all Toy Story 2 and 3 kind of grew out of elements that we had developed in Toy Story 1. Same kind of thing here, where this had an inkling of something that had been discussed before with John and Joe, I think. And John was just looking for the right way to kind of land it, and somehow it sprung out.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Well, you're not going to tell me any more about it at this point, I'd imagine, but,
no,
you know, we can ask. I've got two very quick final questions.
Yeah.
Jonas, one for you. Does Pizza Planet do a broccoli pizza?
Because
broccoli pizza is Riley's sort of bête noir nemesis in this film, really.
Yeah, she's not very happy with the pizza selection where they've just moved. I don't think Pizza Planet would.
No.
Pizza Planet would have good old-fashioned greasy
pepperoni
pizza.
Tastes like cardboard.
That does. That's what she was craving, and unfortunately,
yeah,
they end up in a neighborhood without that.
And Pete, one final one for you. What is it that you and Riley both would miss most about Minnesota?
The mosquitoes. No. I'm looking for something entertaining because all the schmaltzy answers are coming to the people. The people are great.
No, the schmaltzy's fine.
I think that's what it is. It's Minnesota is a land of nice people. They're just really pleasant people to be around. And, you know, I think that's what they're going
to
miss.
So the Coen brothers went to Minnesota to make Fargo, and you went to San Francisco to make Inside Out.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know what that says, but
yeah, that's really interesting.
Anyway, guys, thank you so much for chatting, and best of luck with
the
movie.
Thank you.
And everyone can believe what he says because you can trust him. He's a doctor.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. Now it's time to talk about Inside Out, which is, of course, the story of an 11-year-old girl called Riley whose family moves to San Francisco from their Minnesota home. And she's having trouble adjusting. But we see this through the medium of the tiny little emotions who live in her head, who go on their own adventure. And we see the consequences that has for Riley, or perhaps vice versa. Who knows? So, Dan.
Oh, it's an amazing film.
Yes,
it's lovely. I mean, I'll get the kind of curmudgeonly negative stuff out of the way first. I felt it was a little bit familiar in terms of the plot structure. You know, two mismatched people, in this case, joy and sadness, get displaced and have to go on a journey together. So it had that kind of, you know, buddy odyssey kind of thing that you got from obviously Finding Nemo, and that you got from Up, and that you get from Toy Story, and pretty much every Pixar except maybe The Incredibles. So it had a little bit of that, and for a little while I was watching it, I kind of had that sort of curmudgeonly analytical, I'm not sure, But you just, the emotionality of it is that even a word, emotionality?
It is now.
I think it's something that they use in Tropic Thunder, Dan. So yeah. Congratulations. Yeah. You're now quoting Kirk in Tropic Thunder.
Yes. I'm not saying this review is saying me. Anyway, back to Inside Out. I just thought it's a film about emotions that's massively emotional and colourful and vibrant, and it kind of has Gilliam-esque touches to it as well, like this kind of, you know, things going down up and down tubes. It's kind of this nice sort of elegant steampunkishness to it inside her head, but also it just felt very true. And in terms of you know, what happens as you grow up, as you move from childhood, you know, as you move out of childhood into, you know, teenagerhood,
yes,
and how your emotions change and how your mind actually changes, and, you know, what's actually going on. And it's a wonderful representation of that on a personal level. You know, I've actually got a kid who's slightly younger than that age, and it's a boy, not a girl, but so much felt familiar. And I tell you what really felt familiar, you know, this is the speaking as a father, but you know, that bit where they sat around the dinner table and she's being stroppy with them, and the mum's kind of looking at the dad saying, you need to come in here. And the dad's obviously, he's, you know, his head's off in la 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 la. I'm somewhere. And honestly, everything about it was absolutely nailed on. It's like my, you know, that was my life. And that thing where, you know, obviously anger is controlling the control board of the dad. And that is absolutely, you know, I can't think, I mean, James is controlled by anger. I am controlled by anger. And the way he's like, right, that's it, putting the foot down, that kind of thing. And it's like a scene from my life.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. And it's also like the kind of the little touches. So it's basically about a family that moves to San Francisco for a job. How many animators at Pixar is that true of? Right?
Yes. But if you have to write what you know, they're definitely writing what you know.
They're right doing here. That. Absolutely. I think there's quite a few in jokes in there. But I also kind of like the way that so many movies are going to San Francisco at the moment, but it's supposed to be this amazing place that gets trashed, right?
Yes.
I like the way that A, San Francisco doesn't get trashed in this film, and B, is actually presented as a horrible place to live.
They put broccoli on pizza.
Yeah.
They've ruined pizza.
First the Hawaiians, now San Francisco.
But also great, great, great voice performances. Amy Poehler as Joy is fantastic.
A joy.
And
even.
Richard Kind, who has been in, he was in A Bug's Life, wasn't he?
Was.
He is Bing Bong, who is the surprise character of this film. Not so much of a surprise now as it was when I saw it many, many, many months ago.
You are insufferable, carry on.
Yes. We didn't know he was going to appear in it. And he's like something from Yellow Submarine to look at. He's just like, you know, he's come from this sort of 60s psychedelic kind of place. He's the imaginary friend. And he's a great character, and I won't say too much, but he's very important to the, as I said earlier, the emotionality of the film.
You keep saying that
the
word.
Emotional reality, emotionality. Yeah. Shall I stop gushing now?
No, I want to gush, so maybe actually.
Go.
I just think this is, yeah, it's an absolutely beautiful film. It's, we've talked, ever since Shrek came out, people have been talking about kids' films that also work for adults. And usually that just means that there's a few off-color jokes somewhere that will go straight over the kid's head and the adult will laugh at. And that's usually what that means. This film is a film that has two completely separate levels to it, where the kids are watching some brightly colored characters go on an adventure through a brightly colored place. And the adults are watching completely different film that just happens to be happening at the same time. And there's so much to be unpacked in this film in terms of, you know, the way the brain is structured and, you know, the way they represent these emotions, the way they represent what emotions can do. There's one point where they show a representation of what depression looks like and how depression affects you, which is absolutely stunning. And I think which will do a huge amount to help people sort of understand that disease. There are, you know, things to be unpacked. I feel like people are going to write theses about this film. I honestly think people are going to sort of sit and analyze it and go, well, why is that emotion in control of that person? Because we do see emotions inside the heads of other characters other than Riley.
Mm.
So obviously she's a kid, Joy is in charge. We kind of get that. But why is sadness in charge of somebody else? Why is anger in charge of somebody else, as you touched on?
Mm.
It's fascinating. And what's been interesting has been all of these psychologists and neuroscientists and all these kind of people coming out of the closet to say, yes, this is a, I mean, obviously it's simplified, obviously it's cartoonish, but it's actually pretty sound in terms of how we understand ourselves to work. So it's a film about becoming mature. It's a sort of coming of age story, but without the usual well, here's what we learned at the end. It's actually much deeper and much cleverer.
It's a film about the death of childhood.
Yes, and what it, I would put it differently. I would say it's just, you know, what it means to grow up and what you gain when you grow up that you don't have as a child.
Hmm.
What you begin to see, I guess, nuance and, you know.
But it's this is a very personal film for Doctor, though, isn't it? Because the whole point of it was, I think this came about originally, he said, because he was looking at his teenager and trying to fathom what on earth was going on inside their head.
Yeah.
And this is sort of his attempt to sort of almost represent that, sort of how, you know, cognitive function develops as you get older and why things that as an adult you say that make perfect sense mean something completely different to the child you're talking to.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to sort of, you know, it's a little glimpse inside his head as well, which is quite
absolutely
quite nice.
And a giant, giant head it is. So that was Inside Out, which we gave 5 stars to, as you might have guessed already.
Watch it immediately.
But seriously, it's really, really good. Okay, we've got quite a few films to talk about next, but let's maybe talk about Eden next, because it sort of links in.
There is a similarity. It's obviously a completely different film. Just to explain, Eden is actually probably one of my favourite films of this year. It's a French film. It's by Mia Hansen-Love, who is a very good deft kind of dramatist, but she has made a film where she wanted to basically capture the music scene in Paris from the 90s, really, the kind of the growth of the French touch house scene. Okay, now you're looking at me like, how the hell has this got anything to do with Inside Out? But
no, I was actually looking at you like, this sounds like your kind of film, Dan, because you have been known to enjoy a little dance to some house music.
I am literally the same age, the exact same age as the main character of this film, whose name is Paul, played by Félix de Givry. And he's a DJ and he plays house music and he's enjoying the exact same music that I was into at the exact same time, except in London, Leeds, Manchester. So there's a connection, even though I was never part of, or I never partied in Paris in the 90s or anything like that. But this is another film about growing up. This is another film about the difficulties of, you know, adulthood, if you like. He starts older. He's in his late teens, early 20s, obviously, than the character of Riley. But it's very much a film about. It's kind of I took the message of the movie, and I actually said this in my review for Empire. It's almost like living the dream might not be the best thing for your life. You know, in the same way that Inside Out is like, you know, joy should not necessarily define everything we do. It's life is more complicated than that. So what it does is it follows this guy, and this film's over 2.5 hours long, not wanting to put anyone off, but it follows this guy's life as he goes from his 20s into his 30s, from his 30s into his 40s. And alongside perfectly capturing the music scene, it also follows his relationships. He can't settle down. He is like stuck in a groove, if you like.
Uh-huh.
He's partying, enjoying himself, but he's not setting anything else up in his life. He can't root himself. So he actually goes through a series of girlfriends in his life, and we know that one of them is Mrs. Wright, but she, you know, it doesn't work out that way. One of the girlfriends, by the way, is played by Greta Gerwig. So she has a kind of cameo appearance in this film.
So it's got that kind of indie cred immediately.
It has that kind of indie cred immediately. But she's great. But my favourite thing about it is Daft Punk. We all know Daft Punk. James, even you know Daft Punk.
Yes, I do.
Excellent. There are characters in it because Paul, the main character, is based on Mia Hansen-Love's brother, Sven, who is a real DJ, and most of the stuff happens in the film is based on his life. So Daft Punk are characters in it, and they're great. I mean, they're almost like these kind of, you know, comedy characters on the fringe. There's this amazing scene where they turn up, and obviously they haven't got their robot helmets on. We never seen them as robots in the film. They turn up at a club, and the doorman goes, "Who are you?" And they say their names, you know, Guy-Man and Thomas. And the doorman goes, "No, you're not on the list. You can't come in." And they sort of look at him and go, "Really, we're not on this?" And they go, he looks and goes, "No, you're not on the list." And they go, "Oh man, okay, all right." And they sort of shrug and start slinking off until someone runs up and goes to the doorman, "That's Daft Punk, that's Daft Punk." And he goes, "What, they're Daft Punk?" And they're like, quick, get them in. And it's a great monologue about showgirls in it. You know, there's a lot of humour in it. There's tragedy in it. I really loved it. And I really do strongly recommend it. It's a wonderful piece of counter-programming this week for Inside Out.
Oh, excellent. And that got how many stars?
4. I gave it 4.
4 stars.
Yeah. Didn't get the Dan Jolin 5 because the very ending the very ending didn't feel that real to me. But since having seen it, I've met Sven Hansen-Love, whose life it is based on, and actually how it ended is
is how,
he is now. So it's actually, that is based on real life. So maybe I kind of misjudged that. But
interesting, though. Mm. So if you're in the mood for un film français, well, allez-y and go see Eden. Okay, next let's turn back to the US and do Southpaw, which is a new film from Antoine Fuqua. And it stars Jake Gyllenhaal and 50 Cent and Forest Whitaker and Rachel McAdams. So James, tell us more.
This is a film about Billy the Great Hope, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who is the, I want to say, the light heavyweight, which is something I've never truly understood, the light heavyweight champion of the world, boxing. He's an interesting character. His technique for boxing is to let other people hit him until he gets very, very angry and then to beat them into sort of unconsciousness. But it seems to work quite well for him, certainly at the beginning of the film. If anyone has seen the pictures, Jake Gyllenhaal goes through an astonishing transformation in this. I mean, he is ripped to, put it this way, it makes you want to go to the gym. If anyone is familiar with Kurt Sutter, who is the showrunner, FX showrunner behind Sons of Anarchy and wrote on The Shield, he is a man who likes to put his protagonist through the ringer and then some. And he certainly does heap the bad luck on poor old Billy Hope. He goes bankrupt. His wife gets killed in a kind of an altercation with another boxer. He loses his daughter. He loses his house. He loses his boxing license. I mean, literally, if there's anything that could go wrong, it goes wrong for him. And then there's the gradual sort of realignment, the gradual sort of building himself back up and so on and so forth. It's a good film. It's not a great film. I think it's a fantastic performance by Gyllenhaal, and I did enjoy it. Forest Whitaker's also very good. He's his trainer. But it never quite lands it for me.
I feel like it's a big soppy melodrama. Mm. Like, I mean, it's a Wallace Beery wrestling picture, like they talk about. You know, it's
in Barton Fink.
In Barton Fink, yeah. It's, do you know what I mean? It has the same broad strokes and really simple dynamics, frankly, of that kind of a film. And I think, you know, it papers over that very simplistic kind of story with violence and blood and punching and a great performance from Gyllenhaal. Mm. In fairness, a really, really good performance. But it's a big soppy melodrama. Let's not be like, if you replaced boxing with making cakes, you know, this would be on Lifetime with the exact same story.
I was very sold into the relationship with the daughter. I thought that stuff worked very well. The pacing was slightly odd to me, in that they spend a lot of time on that, and he goes back to court, and then he goes back to court, and then there's a return to boxing at the end, which seems horribly condensed in terms of the chronology. There's also the difficulty that post, you know, about 90-odd Rocky movies, it's quite difficult to effectively make a boxing match dramatic in a new and exciting way. Do you know what I mean? I mean, don't get me wrong, it was done very well with MMA and Warrior, and actually that works very nicely. But yeah, I think it certainly felt to me that Sutter was struggling to convey the drama in the match, and without giving away how he does it, he tries a different tack. I liked the way they were shot. I think they were very kinetic. As I said, Gyllenhaal is terrifying. He's growling and spitting at the camera. But yeah, it lacked a certain oomph. Yes, oomph is the word. There's not enough oomph. More oomph, Kurt.
More oomph, please.
And like, as I say, I love Kurt Sutter. I think he's great. So I kind of had hope for it a bit more.
So that got 3 stars from
it
us.
It did get 3 stars.
Right to you,
it
James?
Does feel right to me, yes. Okay. I wish it had been a 4-star film. It should have been a 4-star
Although 3 stars is, of course, a recommendation.
A recommendation, it is indeed.
As you say.
Next up, Robert Carlyle directing, making his directing debut with The Legend of Barney Thompson, which is the story of another demon barber, because you can never have too many of those. So he's on fine form, it has to be said. He also stars in the film as the titular Barney Thompson. He is a barber in Edinburgh. He apparently went round real barber shops and talked to them and watched them work and learned how to barb.
Cut hair.
Yeah. Mm. But he just, you know, personally and to an extent professionally, but mostly personally, he is hopeless. Like, he's just a sad sack of a man. He's a shadow of a human being, which, as we all know, Robert Carlyle plays brilliantly, almost as well as he plays complete crazy psychos. So it's wonderful casting. Well done, that director. But he turns, he also kind of gets into the slightly darker side because he accidentally murders his boss. This obviously presents him with something of a dilemma, something of a worry. And indeed, Ray Winston plays the cop on his trail, who's convinced that he's uncovered a serial killer on the mean streets of Glasgow and sets out to track him down. So it's quite a tense situation, I think it's fair to say, for Barney. Mm. Really, really good start to this film. Really, really, really good kind of first, I would say, third, maybe almost to the halfway point. It does get a little bit stodgy. The plot gets a little bit too involved, I think, in the second half. And it sort of bogs itself down. But actually, you know, as a debut, it's not unpromising, and I would like to see more. I should also mention Emma Thompson is really good in this. She is absolutely playing it to the hilt. She plays Barney's horrific, awful, terrible mother. I'm not sure she's technically old enough to play Robert Carlyle's mother.
What is the age difference between Emma Thompson and Robert Carlyle?
I mean, I would guess it's in the order of 5 years,
yeah.
I'll be honest.
Yeah.
She is absolutely, I mean, she dowdies herself up magnificently for the role, and she does, you know, seriously steal some scenes as his mother, so it's definitely worth watching. But, you know, a good cast all round, obviously, led by those three, Ashley Jensen also in it. And we liked it. We gave it 3 stars, which is a recommendation. So fingers crossed for more from him in future. But we have one more film to go. James, I think this should go to you.
Ah, yes.
Yes, it is Arnold Schwarzenegger back on our screens in Maggie.
Indeed, Maggie. This is a very simple story. It is the story of a father, Wade Vogel, played by Arnold, whose daughter, played by Abigail Breslin, as the titular character Maggie, has contracted a virus. And it is, in fact, a zombie virus, and it is going to kill her. He takes her out of the quarantine zone, brings her home so that she can spend her last days with him and his wife, her stepmother, played by Jolie Richardson. It is, in many ways, it's kind of a sort of very slow-burning meditation on death and loss and, you know, what it means to lose a child, and it's not a feel-good film. The virus itself is called the necroambulatory virus, which is perhaps the thing about the film I hated the most, because that's just Latin for walking dead and entirely unnecessary. We get it. We understand. The point being that gradually, sort of, she becomes more and more ill. She starts to get cannibalistic urges, she eats a fox, you know, does the stuff that one normally does. And then you get sort of brief glimpses at the world outside as to what's happening elsewhere. They're burning crops, there's starvation, there's problems across the globe. It's an interesting setting. The problem is not a lot really happens. She gradually gets sort of sicker and sicker. He mopes more and more. And it's interesting because, I mean, you could argue, and you wouldn't necessarily be wrong, that this is perhaps the best performance, certainly the best dramatic acting performance Arnold has ever put out. You know, he plays it as a very sort of stoical, you know, quiet man, you know. And you can see the sort of like the pain written on his face. It's very, very palpable. And while he's brilliant in it, I can't help wondering whether a film this sort of slight in terms of scope needed more of a dramatic powerhouse in that role. I think, Dan, you suggested someone like J.K. Simmons, didn't you?
Or Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it's Arnold.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously,
and it's a selling point.
And it helps the film in a, well, I mean, you assume it helps the film because it's like, Arnold, what's, you know, doing this?
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's the problem. Yeah, you're right. There might be an expectation it's a zombie movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. Interestingly, there is that bit early on where he kills a zombie. And then after that happens, there's no more action in the rest of the film, pretty much. So it's almost like there's a little nod to the kind of film. It's almost like an in-joke saying, you think it's going to be this, but actually, no, for the rest of the film, it's something completely different. So it is interesting. And I agree with you, yes. It's actually one of the best performances we've seen from Arnold. It's very different for him. But yeah, it's almost what he kind of does, from what I found he did was he tilt it slightly in the wrong direction because it's him walking around and he is larger than life. Yeah. That's what he does. He's the larger than life guy. He's, you know, he's Mount Rushmore walking around a set. So it's the Matterhorn or whatever. So you kind of like it wrong foots you and it takes away from the naturalistic tone that the director Henry Hobson, this is his first film, he's British, and actually visually, you know, in the style of it's very good. It kind of detracts, I thought, too much. You needed a kind of, you just needed someone who was a, you know, more of a character actor, genuinely a character actor, not a star. It's not a star vehicle, is it?
It's not at all. And I think there's an awful lot of pressure on him because so many of the shots are just Arnold's face and you need to read the emotion from the expressions on his face. And actually, he does carry it across. But again, he plays it as, you know, a very sort of man's man stoical feelings on the inside. So you see the slight furrow of the brow. But I wonder whether we wanted to see, you know, the tortured agony, the kind of silent screams. That's the kind of... Because I didn't quite buy the relationship between him and Maggie, Wade and Maggie. Don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not saying that it didn't work, but I didn't buy the closeness. I didn't feel it. So Southpaw, for example, made me cry, the relationship between father and daughter, not in Maggie.
Okay. And Breslin's good, though.
She is very good.
And it's kind of, yeah, well. I think the film should be subtitled "So Your Daughter's a Zombie," like an educational film. But it had shades of Ginger Snaps. I don't know if people remember Ginger Snaps, which was the kind of obviously the obvious metaphor for werewolves. You know, for lycanthropy is an obvious metaphor for puberty. Mm. And there's a sense of this as well, that there's a kind of, you know, there's another metaphor going on in terms of the relevance of her contracting the zombie plague at that age. And there's a boy in it who's also got the zombie virus that she fancies and stuff. So, you know, there's a lot more going on in it outside of, you know, the Arnold being in it parts. Mm. And yes, she is good. But you're right, I never really bought them as father and daughter particularly.
Richardson, though, I think is very interesting because obviously not Maggie's mother, her stepmother. Mm. And I think plays that very well because she clearly has a fondness for this girl. She's kind of raised her as her own, but she has a real palpable wariness, understandably, because she's got a zombie living in the house. But you know, there's a particular moment where she's looking for a weapon and she grabs a pair of scissors, and so when she goes to get eye drops for Maggie, she's holding this pair, gripping with a death grip onto this pair of scissors in case she needs to defend herself. I thought that was a lovely moment.
I mean, it's a welcome fresh take on the zombie genre. I mean, you know, it just goes to show that you can keep making different kinds of films with zombies in them, and at least this one's not a zombie rom-com again.
Yes, enough of those now, they've been done. Okay, so that got 3 stars.
It did, from us. 3 stars.
Again, a recommendation, but film of the week is With a Bullet, Inside Eden. Out. Inside Out, followed by Eden, and then followed by the others. Anyway, that is it for this week's Empire podcast, which was presented in association with Squarespace. Do stick around at the end as Ali presents you with the science bit and explains all the many ways that Squarespace can help you get your stuff done. Do join us next week for more film-related fun when we will once again be joined by Chris Hewitt and, indeed, far more importantly, celebrity guests. And we'll be bringing you that one from atop a very high thing, which we will be hanging off in honour of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, because it seemed the only possible way to pay tribute to that franchise now in its 5th film. But that's all from us this week, so it's a goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
From James.
Goodbye.
And it's a toodaloo from me. I'm off to pitch Hollywood on my idea for a film based on the alphabet. I feel like if we combine these letters into words, it could make something really special.
Yes, it's Science Bit time with your friendly local regular editor, Ali Plum. Squarespace, of course, is the fun and easy way of creating your own personal website, portfolio, or online store. And guess what? You get a 10% off code with Empire. The word to put into the coupon box is Empire. Empire. E-M-P-I-R-E. It looks professionally designed, no matter what your skill level. There's no coding required. Easy-to-use tools throughout. It's got state-of-the-art technology powering it to make sure it's secure and stable and not going to, like, fall over in the middle of the night. It's trusted by millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world. And it starts at just $8 a month. You can work it out. I think about £5 is about right a month. And you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, remember, Empire's the offer code, 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, as they say, build it beautiful. Thank you for listening not only to this Science Bit, but to the podcast generally.